how big is the chunk of information in order to choose then all of these factors, and then find out if that would be working. Well, we happened to be the only one company that had the smallest amount of information. Now, everything that screws up actually is Fourier. That's what actually is the biggest problem for all the devices that are being sent in space and then communicate with something. Why? Because what Fourier does is we have a simple DOS program, very simple. Then we have the piezoelectric sensor that was placed on the ground. So let's say at the ground of the Mars, let's say, or whichever planet they use it. Then this information went to analog digital converter, and that's where the problem started, because this what is one was then analyzed for what is in one, in the contents of one, how many elements one could contain, and that's what the Fourier does. And then, after that is being done, you gotta send it. And the technology actually wasn't working as a ground penetrating radar. It was the technology utilizing the ever-existing vibration of the Earth structure. And there was a question, how then the natural vibration of the Mars are, or any other planets are, or how is the dependency with the mass of the planet, or the structure of the planet, with this natural vibration to be utilized. So, in other words, what I was trying to comment is, no matter where you have a device that should send the data, the first is not the most important, how much and what kind of transmitter you have, but what is that you're trying to send. And that is actually what determines the factor of the transmitter and the antenna. And
I'm a bit amazed that, Wesley, you're saying that your proposal for measuring what's below the surface of Mars for NASA was not a ground-penetrating radar. That by some other seismic-like technique from orbit, maybe it's going to be a ground vehicle, but I thought it was from orbit, you're going to be measuring, and maybe that's it. Maybe it's going to be a ground vehicle with seismic technique, a seismograph-like machine. You're going to get a three-dimensional picture of what's below the surface of Mars. And the size of that seismograph hardware, the size of the antenna, and the amount of data it gathers. And by the way, when it comes to making the three-dimensional picture, I am curious as to whether or not the first level of data processing, was that going to take place in the vehicle itself, or was all of that going to be sent back as raw data and processed on the ground? I'm going to guess there's some kind of an intermediate. In other words, some data processing on board and the rest of the processing on the ground is going to be my guess. A little bit similar to the way a human eye works. The optical processing that gives you a picture, the first few steps of that optical processing takes place within the pixels of your retina before the data is sent over the optic nerve to the brain, which then further interprets the picture. I may have misunderstood you, so I'm going to turn it back to you, Alex. I mean, Wesley. WX2N. N2XJN. Here we go. K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet November. No, the technology was absolutely different from electromagnetic, seismic, or resistive, or any other methods of existing art. Let me drop for the beep. I didn't hear the beep. Okay. We finally got the patent from patent office for that device. It was a very simple device. The discovery actually happened from the piezoelectric foil. the piezoelectric foil actually put into a kind of metal enclosure and the wire into it, and is able to sense the vibration and eventually create the voltage. Now the voltage then is being sent to a analog digital converter. So the analog signal is actually being digitized. Then there was a very small DOS program, which was actually perfect for a space device to utilize that. But there was no way to do it remotely. So that information was sent to air and then analyzed. It had to be done in one unit because it had to be compared with the next reading. And the way it was done, it was the physically placed sensor on the structure of the earth was able to penetrate up to 2 miles and see everything possible being the structure of the earth. The only what we did not know is what we see. So if there was a layer of gravel, or there was a layer of clay, I could see perfectly the differences and the borders between the structures, but I was not able to say what is that. That there was some inconsistency with how we can see the cavity, because then I went with when I was in Army Rangers, and I was talking in front of 200 scientists, civil and military, in Columbus, Georgia. I was approached with the questions, and then I found that I could actually have the geophysical bomb that doesn't kill anybody, but it spikes, it divides to thousands of devices, and these devices are simply dropped to the enemy ground. They send the signal, and the balloon with the deployed repeater is able to send the link to the satellite, and then eventually, for that period of time before all of the sensors are being destroyed, which is too many for them, we're able to see what is the cavities. But we had some problems with these cavities, And then because of these problems and many other problems, the technology... Let me drop for a moment. Okay. The technology was kind of... We are, NASA, we are very much conservative in what we're taking. So they didn't take any. So the only reward that we've got is that from 3 technologies that were actually nominated, NASA didn't take one of them. But what I'm trying to say is that the uniqueness of the technology was that we found, I have no idea what is that happening, that if you place the hammer, the simple contractor hammer, next to the vicinity of the sensor, and you knock that ground, even though this sensor is reading the naturally existing vibrations, and so it's not sending any signal back, we were able to achieve the amplification of the signals of 2 to 3,000 times. We saw this, and from the amplitude of that computer that was connected to analog and digital device and to the sensor. Anyhow, what I'm trying to say is that so far, till I know, and I'm trying to read and follow that, there is no proven technology, especially ground penetrating radar is very, very, very shallow. It's only a few meters, or is coming to 15, 20 meters, that's the maximum. That's what is NASA is not looking for. And then what I mentioned before about all of this the information, of this requirement, size of the chunk of the data, format, power, and antenna. And that has to match with the technology. So they are not easy to deal with and to share.
Sounds like a nice cutting edge, out of the box thinking project you were on. And I almost understand how it works from your explanation. In other words, the piezoelectric foil was the transducer, the sensor. I have the impression they became directly in contact with the Martian soil. If it's an imaging of the below surface of Mars you desire. What I don't yet know is where is the source of the seismic signal that those transducers, those sensors, are going to sense. Are the sensors bidirectional? Are they both transmitting and receiving? Or in your example, you talked about hitting the ground with a hammer in the near vicinity as a calibration technique. Was there going to be some other thing that thumped the ground? And then you have an array of these piezoelectric foil sensors picking up the resultant propagating signal through the ground, the P wave and the S wave and everything else, and making a three-dimensional image out of it. It's a kind of a phased array, XY phased array we're talking about here, and a kind of a Fourier transform will eventually, with the right processing, allow you to get a three-dimensional picture. But where was the source of what I think is a seismic signal? Was it going to be the natural, what do you call it now, earthquake, so to speak, micro-earthquake on Mars? Is that the source of the signal? Or was there really going to be a thumper somewhere, like the hammer? Or was, were the sensors going to be the initiator of the signal that later got measured after reflected off various densities below the surface of Mars? Where was the source of the signal, Wesley? N2XJN, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Okay, November 2X-ray, Juliet, November. That's an excellent question. There was no source of men created vibration in the sense of it. The device took the first approach to ever existing vibration, and these vibrations are the natural seismic vibration of the Earth. So instead of sending the power, like the seismic method, you send a tremendous amount of power because, let's say, of explosives. Then 20, 30, 50 feet below the ground level, you're losing about 75% of that power. Now, the rest of it is being lost on the way of return. So actually what you're dealing with is 3%, 2%, sometimes less. Now, the technique, forget about the hammer for now. Just forget about the hammer. Let me drop for a moment. Okay. Now, this vibration could be the ever-existing Mars vibration. Is okay. Natural seismic vibration of the Earth. Then, the second one. The vibration from the fact of the Earth taking the rotation by itself and the mass within the Earth that is taking the movement. The core. Another factor is men created vibrations. One thing that I add, another factor is the rotation of air in the solar system. Now, any addition to these vibrations, like the earthquakes and whatsoever, it only takes a positive. It only hits positive to the readings, and what we were trying to do is just place that piezoelectric material and read what we're getting from. It doesn't matter whether you send the explosive using the explosive device, the vibration down there. You can control the nature of this explosive frequency that you created. You just analyze what you're getting. Or you just read every existing vibration. That was very first approach. At that time, when we present that to NASA, we did not have it physically patent yet. We've got that just a little later. But anyhow, the technology was absolutely great, and I believe it is great. That lead me also to another factor. When, by an accident, Igor Zhukov, who was my scientist, knocked the hammer next to the vicinity of the sensor, we discovered 2,000 times the amplitude of that ever-existing vibration was bigger. And that led me to thinking about creating the communication, like the telephone communication, using ground, only ground, and utilizing the vibration and modulating the vibration, and using from time to time, because what is happening is Earth is extremely good resonant and vibrational source. What people think is not, because they were trying to send the vibration. Now let me stop for a moment. Okay. The major problem that people had is they were trying to reach vibration from the deepness, not from the surface. Now, think about railroad. 10 miles away, you can put your ear to that metal, and you can hear the train going down. But you could hear the small hammer that was knocking Morse code from that. I have never had a chance to patent it or think more, but I have some ideas how to do it. But actually, I believe there is a way to create a communication using no wires at all. Absolutely no wires. There would be the read light translating or the amplifying devices placed somewhere. And that would be the way to send the voice, which is modulation the vibration of the Earth, or the vibration of whatever you created. And just because of the simple fact, the discovery of mine, actually it was accidental, that when you put, you knock, not even with a hammer, I was trying to knock the ground with my finger and not with the nail, just a finger, soft finger. And we've got amplification about 700 times. Back to you, and to Israel.
Was it natural seismic activity of Mars? Was that to be the major source of signal? Or was the source of the seismic signal going to be artificially induced? Or both? Back to you, Wesley, into XJN with a delay, KQRIW.
Okay, when I was talking to Alexander Martins from CDC NASA, one of the questions, and also I believe I got to take a look at, I have tons of papers from that activity, from that time. We have signed the non-disclosure agreement with Los Alamos National Laboratory and many other institutions, but one of the questions is, what we see and observe in the Earth, would that be repeated? Because the device by itself did not have a need for any external source of the man-made or artificial source of vibration. So there was not a seismic method. But the thing is, how did the surface of Mars and the structure with that surface and everything that we know about how the Mars is built inside react with the device? So the NASA in that particular program did not decide to use any one of three chosen projects. And one project, our project was one of the three of them. And to explain.
Okay. Did I sense then that the source of the signal is part of your patent, and that's proprietary. The processing is a kind of somewhat known seismic imaging Fourier transform. Is that approximately true, Wesley? Go ahead.
Well, to make the things very simple, all of this technology is taking the piezoelectric foil, put it in a metal enclosure, take ready-made in the United States analog-to-digital converter, use a piece of tool software analyzing that received vibrations, and the piece of foil is very much directional. It's not spreading something that is 5, 10, 20 feet away. It's very much directional. And then you use the piece of computer, and in that computer you use just a photostyler or any kind of the programs that are able to take this data that is analyzed with Fourier and actually put it in any kind of graphical form. So then you get these layers. And I remember when I was in gold mine in El Cerro Nevada, there was Murari gold mine. We were looking for not a gold. They didn't ask us for a gold, something else. But when we were in the part that was underground part, we actually discovered the missing tunnels. They had no idea that they exist because they were filled with water. We could see the water very well, very well. Water was something that was out of question. The cavity was the question. The problem with the cavity was the problem. So my understanding is that someone of you just taking a simple graphical program, the analog digital converter, and a piece of that foil is able to make this device, simple like that, and to exist.
Hello, out of Yonkers. Yonkers is noticed. Very good, Alex. Is there a commercial product of the piezoelectric foil transducer, or is that the nature of your patent? One of the patents. Is that not yet a commercial product? Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay. The nature of the patent was not the method, because all of the pieces of this stuff were known prior to send it to the patent office. The nature of that was find the mathematical equation, which was the work of Alex with Igor Zhukov. That was his work, and find the mathematical equation giving the depth. So what that you see the structure, so what that you see cut off the ground to the certain depth, and you are able to see to the see the vibration between the part of the ground, so gravel, clay, whatsoever it is over there, but you don't know what is the depth of that. So the technique with the mathematical equation that was very simple was the nature of that, that we've got the patent from the patent office. And to exchange.
Was the special sauce that you and your people had, was it the method of calibrating that transducer so that with high accuracy you knew its transfer curve? Was that part of the special sauce, the invention? Back to you, Wesley.
No, the answer is no. There was no calibration needed or required. The mathematical equation related to the earth and the structure of the earth was accurate enough. With a depth of 50 meters, we were able to keep the accuracy of about few centimeters. The problem was with the number of points, measurement points. That was another problem for the technology. So the technology has many downsides. Let's say they're building the road or the highway, and we need to come, the more shallow we go, the smaller the space between measurement points. So let's say we go to the depth of, let's say, 5 meters, then we had to be within centimeters apart from one point of measurement to the other in order to find the continuous data, not only the data in this particular point. So it is good. It takes the time, but it is good. I remember I was working for the Federal Highway Administration Department of Transportation in Virginia and Ohio, Mr. Tom Levchik, and the task was actually to find the 100 years ago people were digging for the coal, and they had all of these tunnels. And then later on there were highways, and the highways actually collapsed, and there was a danger. So we were able to find exactly these tunnels. By that time we had that cavity problem mostly resolved, and we got a lot of good from that intuition.
In order to get a clear image of what's going on below the ground, it is my guess that you have to know with high accuracy the XYZ address of each one of your transducers, each one of your sensors. That would be called the address matrix. That in turn becomes a steering matrix. You have to worry about the cross-coupling between the sensors, interference covariance matrix. Part of what you are going to be doing, I think, is called the Widrow algorithm in order to do imaging of this. It's really a kind of phased array. It's an acoustic phased array is what I think you're describing. So if it was going to be a Mars vehicle, I suspect it would be a bit difficult to design a vehicle that places each one of the sensors on the Martian surface with reasonably high known accuracy of their XYZ position, and then, as I understand, wirelessly you're going to be gathering the signal from each of your transducers, and that becomes your raw data input to this array processing algorithm. Is that approximately what you were intending to do? N2XJN, wait for the beep. HULIW.
No, the answer is no. November to X-ray, Juliet November. At first, the technology wasn't able to achieve tri-dimensional imaging. All we were able to do is a two-dimensional imaging of the depth across the way of measurement. So, in other words, if you draw the line on the surface of the Earth, and the line is 100 meters long, and then you are concentrating yourself on gathering the data of the depth of, let's say, 20 meters or 1 mile. It's up to you. Then the steps that you have to proceed is, the more shallow you go, the more point of measurement is required, and at the same time, you are able only to do to find what is at that particular line. So if, let's say, there is something that is rounded like a huge pipe, and you just miss the pipe by few feet or 1 foot, you're not able to see that. Or if that pipe being the ground level is parallel to the line, you will never find it. So the technology was not three-dimensional, was two-dimensional. And that's what actually why Kennecott Corporation, that was a copper mining entity in Salt Lake City, what they were actually giving us as the minus of the technology, that comparing to any other known methods. But the only plus of the technology was absolute depth. We could go very, very deep and to exist.
Rather fascinating. It does sound like a lot of capability. I'm going to have a little bit of fun with you, Wesley, and ask you, do you practice the book that you preach? In the beginning of the TechNet, you told me about the length of time that we dwell on a subject before we go to the next subject, and that we should be a little more brief and gather the data and present it in a form where people get useful knowledge out of it and learning. We've been on this subject for a considerable length of time. Are you and I together as brief as we desire to be when we start a conversation like this? Back to you, Wesley, KQIW.
No, we are not. And you're completely right about it. The only thing is that for you as a very much teacher, a person who is at first gathering the information, then is asking logical questions, and then is coming with everything that you do not know on it, and I'm the one who is answering. Now, with my ability to express myself that is very much limited, I am just longer than anybody else, and that requires from the listeners to be just understanding that. But yes, I'm not doing that. It is not what I was trying to point. What I was trying to point when I said at the beginning of the conversation that it could be something that somebody is having a question, he gets to you with that question, and then next week another person who feels that is prepared very much, within 5 minutes is able to answer that question. So, and if there are any questions to that, the subject is being discussed. Now, if there is nobody that is interested in it, it dies. So, this is what I was saying. But one of the things that fascinates me with that is, forget about all of the techniques. If somebody could think about just a simple piezoelectric foil and ability to modulate the vibration to the point that the wires are no longer used and the voice could be sent through the earth. Like I said about the railroad, that is really fascinating. And right there.
Hey, Wesley, you should check out Duke University, their echo department. You will find very interesting stuff out there.
How I like this voice. Alex, go ahead.
Well, I said what I said. You have to do your research. I mean, most of that stuff, it's already out there in the internet. Two-dimensional echo is used by the submarines probably 50 years ago. Now they don't do that anymore. Sonograms, stuff like this. But Duke University has now very nice little foils like you describe, which are actually multi-layer piezos, and they're trying to do the focusing in physical material rather than in electronics. I don't want to monopolize here. RIW, Antoninio, sorry for barging in.
I'm not sure how well Wesley and Alex knew each other before meeting again on the technical net. You were into imaging technology among very many other things, Wesley, and by way of all of the experience of radar and ultrasound imaging, the array techniques that Alex has worked on has a lot to offer in what you were doing. So maybe you made a mistake, Wesley. How come you didn't hire Alex to join your team? N2XJN, K2RIW?
I would love to do it, N2XJN. When he starts to talk, I just love when he is just talking. So I start to... the guy has absolutely enormous knowledge. Absolutely. And he has much better English than I have. So, you know, and he's very understanding. That's what I like about him, N2XJN.
And both he and you are ultimately able to realize that nobody bats a thousand. Nobody is accurate all the time. The Europeans 2 weeks ago, when discussing the stuck throttle automobile problem,
because of their strong experience of downshifting. They at first thought the solution would be downshifting. And I was thinking about you two guys as I read a report a couple of days ago from another man who came close to dying in his automobile because of a stuck throttle. He managed to catch the problem early enough in the scenario, and he applied very strong braking early enough to slow down the car. That's the good news. The bad news is as the car got from 60 miles down to, I think he said, 25 or 30 miles an hour, and the computer realized that full power was being commanded, and the vehicle was slowing down, so the computer thought the vehicle was climbing a hill. So it automatically downshifted. First went into second, and then went into first gear. When the computer automatically did that, without him asking for it, and he's standing on the brakes with all the force he's got, because it was downshifting and developing more and more torque at the wheels with a flat-out engine, with him riding on the brakes, getting down to a nice slow velocity, it started speeding back up again. And if that particular individual hadn't realized he's got to turn off the key or go into neutral, if he hadn't done whichever he did, that downshifting would have killed him. It would have gotten him down to 40 miles an hour with the engine running at red line, and whatever is in front of him, he was going to strike it at 40 miles an hour, and his chances of surviving would have been very poor. So there's an example of what happens with downshifting in this scenario. And it gave me a little bit of confidence in what I was trying to say the previous week, that that's not the solution. It's got to be neutral and key off. And heaven help you if you're in a brand new vehicle that runs by a push button instead of a key, and you don't know that holding the starter button in for 3 seconds kills the engine. Without knowing that, you're in an awful lot of trouble. So as you can see, we've gone through a full circle on this particular problem, and it's not going to go away. There's got to be more people getting in trouble before all of this recall takes place. And I think one of the main things going to happen in the recall is the so-called smart brake program is going to be installed, where the computer is taught that when somebody is commanding the brake, at the same time the throttle is wide open, the computer must ignore the throttle command, go back to idle, and only pay attention to the brakes. The brakes dominate. Right now the computer doesn't know that. So a lot of software writing has to take place on all these recalled vehicles. And let's hope they get it right and the software itself doesn't create other bugs. As our computer running cars get more and more complicated with the emission control computer, let me drop. In order to try to control the emissions, in order to try to run the engine at highest efficiency to get the best miles per gallon and the least amount of pollutants coming out of it, they're trying to adjust mixture and timing and the throttle and trying to do all kinds of things at once. I think that's the main reason why we don't have a simple linkage anymore, a simple speedometer cable, coaxial cable that runs between the gas pedal and the throttle. The engine is now being ordered to perform in a much more complicated manner in order to meet all of our requirements. So we've been through quite a learning curve on all of this, and we haven't got the whole answer yet, but at least I'm hoping that we've instructed a number of people. I'm starting to hear more and more news reports that are not just telling people how bad it is and how controversial it is and how much denial the automobile companies are in, and the fact that whenever fly-by-wire vehicles have come around, Audi and BMW and others have been doing it a long time ago, and occasionally running into the runaway problem. This is not a new problem, and it requires a much more sophisticated solution. So I'm starting to hear news reports that tell people what to do, neutral and key. You've got to disconnect that engine from the wheels when it's doing that. You may not gather control by any other means. Anybody want to make any further comments on that one before we leave it? Go back. Real soon, we've got to get over to Mel and the mailbag. Anyone have any comments on any of the subjects on the table? Choose it. K2RAW in the second half. We're listening.
Okay.
SYL, comments?
I have a comment, too.
think I heard Alex, Wesley, and S-Y-L. I think in that order. I go right ahead, Alex. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, I come to the realization that what you're saying, disconnecting the engine, could be a solution, but it's not the proper one. We want to kill the engine. We want the engine to be still there, but inactive. So one way to it, it is to turn off the key, to turn off the engine, if you have the presence of spirit to do that, or to flood it, just floor the pedal. Flood it until the engine cannot take it anymore. But the idea is to keep the engine in there because the transmission is your only breaking point. Perhaps while it's still revving, the engine, it's a bad idea to have it there. But once you turn off the engine, for example, you downshift, turn it off. That's it. Now you are in the first, third gear, and then you can downshift to the second gear if you want, even if the engine is off. I think that will be the proper solution. But I think we beat this horse to death. Perhaps next time around or whatever, we're going to speak briefly about the perils of having a cellular phone. I think I'm going to write a white paper that actually the phone is killing you. And you're going to have fun with it, Dick. K2IRW and 2UN, and you're having fun in here.
Okay, I'm going to quite strongly disagree with what you said. And I don't have the whole answer, but I'm going to give you some more evidence. You want to floor the gas pedal to flood the engine. You cannot do that. You're not talking to an engine, you're talking to a computer. But your computer already has the command completely flawed. The computer thinks the gas pedal is against the firewall. You can't go any further. It's already there. You can't flood it. On top of that, the emission control computer will not allow you to change the mixture on that engine. He's continuously adjusting that engine to get maximum power or maximum efficiency. When you floor it, he gives up on maximum efficiency and he goes to maximum power. You're trying to override a program and he's going to fight you like crazy. You can't do that. And the reason why I say neutral first and off second is that in neutral, who cares if the engine is racing and making a lot of noise? The computer has a rev limit built in. That combined with the hydraulic lifters floating will not allow you to go fast enough to damage the engine. But with the engine running and the transmission in neutral, you have power steering. And you have the chance of developing a little bit of vacuum, and therefore you have the brake assistance vacuum. If you do completely turn off the engine, you're down to manual steering, and some people, their car is so tough to steer without power steering, they may not be able to do it. Particularly an untrained, weaker woman might not be able to do that. And with the engine off, you no longer have any ability to develop vacuum to get full of braking back. Your brakes never completely fail. The problem is that when the engine is producing maximum horsepower and the brakes are already hot, the engine has more power than braking, than you've got braking. If you can kill that power to the wheels in neutral, and if you can stop that engine from being controlled, touching those wheels, what little bit of braking you've got will stop you. It'll take a little while, but at least your speed will continuously decrease. You've always got some brake, just not enough when the engine's connected. You cannot downshift at high velocity. If you're moving 100 miles an hour and you command it to go into second gear or first gear, the computer on the transmission will not let you do that. It's saving the life of the transmission. It knows the transmission would be damaged if you could do that. Same thing if you commanded reverse. It won't let you do it. There's three computer programs in there that are fighting you, Alex. You've got good logical solutions. The computers won't let you do it. N2NNU for a rebuttal.
There I go. Come to
computers are controlled by Russian mafia, my friend. In Mama's kingdom.
Okay, Dick. As I said, this seems to be a religious war now, but in a sense you're right. Computers is the computer is bottling everything else. So I tried with my old Saturn, which is actually an what is it? An Audi? I think it's an Audi. And I was able to downshift about 60 miles an hour with pedal halfway down. So it produces quite a jolt, but they never complained that I do that. Anyhow, let's put that to rest. But I called today Toyota, and they offered a solution, a very cheap solution. Every Toyota should now, from now, carry a three-prong anchor. And that when that issue is happening, the driver, all that he has to do is just to throw the anchor out of the window, and that will stop the car. Back to you, Dick.
I know that's a joke. That anchor would just be bouncing on the road. It would not catch on to anything. And if it did catch on to anything, the chain going to the anchor doesn't have anywhere near enough spring action. Whatever that anchor is attached to in the car, you just rip out that attachment or break the chain. You've got a tremendous amount of energy, rolling kinetic energy, thousands and thousands of calories or watt seconds or joules of energy on that vehicle moving 100 miles an hour. And if you're going to stop it without smearing the human being against the windshield, you've got to do a controlled stop. The anchor is fun to talk about, and it makes a good cartoon, but of course it's not realistic. Wesley was the next person, and then Bill in that order. Go ahead, Wesley, you had a comment. N2XJN, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
What about hydraulic hijacks pressing against the road from underneath the car?
Okay, N2XJN.
You've got it, Wesley.
Okay. I have a question. And it might be cheating. I'm sorry. Okay. The computer got stuck. You're switching off the engine for a moment, getting to know yourself while you're running. You're starting the engine again. How about if the second scenario would be this? There is a mounted by manufacturer, by whoever, switch that is able to disable the power coming from the computer for a moment, just to reset that. And so is it.
That may work a certain percentage of the time, but Eric told us that one of the failures is that the throttle or gas pedal potentiometer works by having a light-emitting diode talking to a light detecting diode. And if the light emitting diode or the light detecting diode fails, you're stuck in neutral, no problem. If the light detector becomes a short circuit, the computer thinks you have commanded maximum power. If that light detecting diode short circuit is causing the problem, and a certain percentage of the time, he was told that that's what happened on a Prius automobile, in which case you can turn off the engine as many times as you want, you can reset the computer as many times as you want. It'll keep coming back to life at full power, and it'll get you. And you'll have to use some strong, salty language, and it won't do you any good. You gotta kill that engine, or you gotta put it into neutral. The main solution that I think Toyota is really going to use is to install something that was invented a couple of years ago by BMW or Audi, I'm not sure which. It's called smart brakes. And that is, when the brakes are commanded, the computer is told, do not allow the throttle to be wide open, to go back to idle. And if that doesn't work, to automatically shift into neutral. The smart brakes computer program says that the braking command dominates, that once you're asking for brakes, because you press the brake pedal, it disconnects cruise control actually the main change that's going to take place during this recall. Thank you for any further comments on that one, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW.
If you are curious why they put that in the cars, let me tell you why.
Okay. I know Alex is going to attack me, but he would be right. Transopter is built this way, that this dial is inside the chip. And then, so that means you have a light source inside the chip, and then you have a transistor, which, or the dial. That's the chip. It has four legs. That's the typical transopter. Now, if you put the disconnect device, a small switch, just cutting off the incoming light signal, then you actually disabling the dial, the pedal, the structure, with everything. And I'm just curious what Alex is gonna say about it.
I don't think so. Let me drop. The light emitting diode produces light, and the more light that is received by the detector becomes a lower impedance, and that means more throttle is being commanded. You can disconnect the switch on the light emitting diode if the light detecting diode has become a short circuit. You're still in maximum throttle command. If you install the switch on the light detector to open up that circuit, yes, you're now commanding idle speed. That will protect you from a shorted detector, but it won't protect you from an error in the computer program. There is a theory, it's hard to confirm, that intermittently the computer program develops a glitch, and it thinks you've commanded maximum throttle when you haven't done anything. So the switch will protect you if the switch is in the right spot a certain percentage of the time. It's not going to protect you all the time. I think a better solution is smart brakes. As I said, Audi and BMW, quite a few years ago, chose to go that way because their vehicles were occasionally running away. Toyota has to accept that as a solution. It's the best one known to date, that the braking command dominates and tells the computer, I don't care what the hell you're doing, go to idle on the engine when the brakes are commanded. Anybody want to make a comment on that? K2LIW.
This mobile extractor monkey.
Oh, the guy that designed that critical part of the system, I mean the whole car, should be put to the wall and shot. At least the architect. You know, you're designing a critical part of a system without a backup on it. That's ridiculous.
KC2QIQ.
Dick. In Europe, motor car sports are very, very big. You will find every weekend drag racing and whatnot, and many, many people got killed out there. So this is their response, the automotive industry response, so you cannot spin your wheels while you are pressing on the brakes. Drag racing is out of the question now. So that's where the smart brakes are coming from, back to you.
Agreed. Okay, we've got SYL and QCQ in that order. Who want to make comments? Bill, KC2SYL, go right ahead with your comment.
Thanks, Dick. For Toyota specifically, I'm not sure about other makes of cars, but I can see for Toyota at least a four-step process. First of all, I think some of it may be related to the cruise control. I know on a Toyota that we have, you can disengage the cruise control, stepping gas pedal, but that really doesn't disable. Cruise control will still be active. If you inadvertently hit the cruise control lever, which on a Toyota is on the right-hand side of the steering wheel, that'll go back into cruise control.
Hey, here is the perfect solution.
Two-step process is to disengage the cruise control and then disable it. That way, even if you inadvertently hit the lever one time that should not go back into activity. The second comment I have about Toyota is about gear shift levels. It's actually a two-step process. If you look at the gear shift level, which is on a console between the two seats, it goes into the drive, 1, 2, 3, whatever it is. But there's also another slot that you can slide the gear shift into, and I think that was designed so people inadvertently do not move or their elbow hit the gear shift level while the car is in motion. It's sort of a lock. So I think specifically for Toyotas, it's at least a four-step process. Disengage the cruise control, then disable it. As a matter of course, when you get out of the car, and then certainly for the gear shift level, now when you step on a brake, you probably have to move that gear shift level if it is in a locked position to the neutral position. And that's only for Toyota cars. I'm not sure about Hondas and other makes that have a center console gear shift back in it.
Yeah, Alex thinks that there's a solution there, but I'm not so sure. Bill, I've got to ask you a further question. You said that when you press the brakes, the cruise control is disengaged, and you're speculating that somebody hit the cruise control lever again and it tried to restore. That doesn't completely explain it, because the stories we're hearing are people who ride the brakes continuously and the vehicle is still accelerating. I don't think it's cruise control. Cruise control is an aggravating factor, but I don't think cruise control is really creating the dangerous situation, because current vehicles, thank goodness, do disconnect cruise control when you hit the brakes. And if a person is riding those brakes and the velocity is increasing, it ain't the cruise control. That's my feeling. Back to you, Bill, for a comment on that. And then we'll go to the next people. KC2SYL, K2RIW, wait for the beep.
Patience listening. Program.
Yes, I agree. Just as a matter of course, disengage and disable the cruise control. You're right. I agree with you. Back to that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, in the list, Glenn was the next person. KC2QIQ. Go right ahead, Glenn. Hey, Glenn, how would you solve all this? Wait for the beep. You got it.
There's been no speckers, Sam. Thanks.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I just have to say, I'm really not a fan of any of these electrically operated, gas pedals. And I think these throttle controls that are electronically controlled, it's got to be something that's rethought, because I think another scenario that still could be one of the problems here is that whatever the motor is that's controlling the throttle in itself can get stuck. And if that gets stuck, all the computer commands in the world aren't going to return that throttle back. The other problems that can happen here, too, are this is going to be some kind of an electronic driver, some kind of a driver control that's going to send a signal to that motor, and that could fail once it's in the open condition. So it only opens, and it can increment open, but it can't increment closed. Another very, very dangerous mode of failure here. Until they really identify what these problems are, I don't know, I think I feel a lot more comfortable with the old-fashioned cable and the return spring. Over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Absolutely.
A guy I worked with had a Cadillac automobile with a purely mechanical connection between the gas pedal and the throttle. And for some reason, the return spring became a broken return spring. It broke open. The throttle went to maximum. And because of the way it was wired, even when he reached down to the floor and picked up the gas pedal, he couldn't stop the engine from going full blast. So even mechanical linkage can give you a failure. There's a couple of reasons why they're using electronic control. But you're onto something with that servo. We'll get to that in a second. The reason for the electronic control is that when you command a particular speed and you're already at a particular velocity, for each velocity you're at, for each speed you've commanded, there's an ideal setting of the throttle butterfly, there's an ideal setting of the fuel injection mixture, there's an ideal setting of the timing, there's a whole lot of things going on in order to get maximum efficiency, maximum power, minimum emissions. So they want the computer to be there to do all of those things so that they can meet the requirements. Particularly in California, where they're demanding higher and higher gas mileage on cars, they have no choice. It's got to have all these elaborate interconnects. But the thing that you're onto, Glenn, and you hit the nail on the head. After the electronic command, the computer is telling the butterfly to go to a particular position by way of a motor. And the motor knows where the butterfly is by way of a